As you know, it's important to me that the supplements I recommend and use are of the highest quality. That's why I stock the Protocol for Life Balance product line in my online dispensary, drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance offers a wide range of professional-grade products using ingredients backed by strong scientific research, including a suite of supplements supporting your cardiovascular health, Clinical Cardio 6, Ubiquinol, and K2, MK7, and D3. This collection offers a powerful combination of targeted nutrients and botanicals that are known to promote optimal cardiovascular health by supporting healthy blood pressure, arterial flexibility, cellular energy production, neutralization of free radicals, protection against oxidative stress, and promotion of healthy vascular structures. For more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance is an A-rated GMP manufacturer of premium dietary supplements. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. A fascinating discussion about an integrative approach to prostate cancer. That will be the subject of an upcoming prostate cancer summit that we want to let you know about, because I think for those of you who may be suffering from prostate cancer, or if you're just a man in your 60s or 70s, you got to start thinking about prostate cancer because it is so ubiquitous, or perhaps you're the significant other of a man with prostate cancer. Men with prostate cancer are kind of like a deer in the headlights, and they rely on a significant other to help them through it. So it's a team effort. With us today is Dr. Gio Espinosa, who is the curator of all the wonderful guests who are going to be speaking at the Prostate Cancer Summit. And I'm pleased to say that he invited me to share my perspective. But there are a lot more luminaries that you can hear from if you go to drgio.com. That's a place where you can find out about the Prostate Cancer Summit. November 19th is when it drops, by the way. So I know that this is going to be covered in depth, but, you know, give us a little bit of a teaser about prostate cancer detection, because there's a lot of concern that men have, rightly so, about biopsies. Now, they say, no big deal, but yeah, maybe a 1% complication rate with that. That may mean that you have bleeding through the penis, that you have pain, that you have ejaculatory problems. That's going to dissuade a lot of men from getting their prostates checked out. So short of a biopsy, their tests. And the PSA, highly controversial, as you know. Even the Cochrane Collaborative, which is the, you know, they're kind of like the referees about which treatments, which tests people should get. They sort of say, PSAs, we're not sure if they make a difference, really. So that's a controversy.
All right. This is something.
Take a deep breath.
Where do I start? First of all, let's start with this. PSA, the PSA test, is a useful test. You cannot throw the baby out. Sorry, I've got my. You cannot throw the baby out with the bathwater, as they say. It's a useful test. How do we know this? Before PSA, the advent of the PSA test, we're talking before 1989, those men who came in with prostate cancer already had a 40% chance of having aggressive and advanced and even metastatic prostate cancer. After the PSA test, which was about 89, 1990, 20 years after that, around the year 2000, only 4% of men who came in had aggressive prostate cancer relative to 40%. So it did work. The problem is that it worked too well. Why? Because most men who, or many men who were diagnosed and treated, they would never have died from their disease. That's why we have something called active surveillance, not a low-risk disease.
So there's a, there's a risk of overdiagnosis leading to overtreatment.
Over biopsying and over treatment, which then comes with other consequences that is very expensive as well. urinary incontinence and things like that. So most men walking around, and only 10%, you know, I'm in this homogenous environment where all I see is high PSAs. But the truth is that most men walking around the world don't have a high PSA, right? Only about 10% do.
What is considered a high PSA? It's age-related too, right?
It's age-related, and that's the other important thing. Back in the day, it was considered 0 to 4, period, end of story.
Yeah.
And look, I think your listener needs to know that that range means nothing. They're going to see this range in the lab report, mm-hmm. and going to think, well, my PSA is 2.5 or my PSA is 4.1. That range between 0 to 4 means absolutely nothing. Okay, so that's important to know. So if you are 40 years old, let's just say 40, 45 years old, and your PSA is honestly anything higher than 1, that's considered high.
Mm-hmm.
If you're 60 years old, and your PSA is 2 or 2.5, that's not high. It's age dependent, quite by far. So that's that. The other component, this is why it's a good test, right? Because if you're 45 years old, you get a simple test, inexpensive, and if it's, you know, higher than 1, well, some red flags. So it's a good test. So then the other component about PSA that's useful, it's how it changes with time. So it's called PSA velocity or kinetics. So if the PSA today, just to keep the conversation and the examples simple, man that's 45 years old, his PSA today is 1.0. I said, all right, well, we're on the cutoff for his age. He comes back 3 months later, his PSA is now 2.5. That's a significant leap from 3 months prior. So then now it's like, okay, we need to investigate this. So it is useful. Lastly, PSA density is useful. What does that mean? That means that we're trying to determine the difference between PSA being high from prostate cancer or just an enlarged prostate. So it's a simple calculation of PSA value over the size of PSA. So
how do you ascertain the size? Well, from an ultrasound or an MRI and not from just a digital rectal exam.
No. That means nothing. Look, I've done thousands of those tests, and I can't tell you how often I've been wrong. And I used to say, oh yeah, 40 grams or this and that. And then when we do an MRI, it's like, oh my goodness, it's 60 grams or 70 grams. So that you can't really tell. And I'm experienced in this, and you can't really tell the size of the prostate. So the PSA density, better from an MRI, is more accurate than an ultrasound.
Okay.
You could calculate a PSA density. So that's useful.
So now, short of a biopsy, we have some options, right? We could do the PSA.
You're still not ready for the biopsy. Okay. No biopsy. Certainly not in my book.
So there's a 4K test, from what I understand.
There's also
percentage PSA, free PSA that kind of informs you, but it's not definitive. These are options.
So PSA and all the elements of PSA include PSA density. Then it's free PSA percentage. The cutoff there also depends on age. I like it to see higher than 25%. If it's 20%, I don't say biopsy right away, or even if it's sometimes 15%. Depends on age and other things. Then the 4K score is another blood test that it's, again, more sensitive. It does use, so PSA is a protein, a proteolytic enzyme is a protein. That it's called a kallikrein, is under the category of kallikreins. It's just a bunch of proteins that are found throughout the body. And it's one kind of kallikrein. The 4K score measures 4 kallikreins from the prostate. And so then the 4 kallikreins, including PSA, they put it in some sort of algorithm. It's more specific and sensitive to prostate cancer than just 1 kallikrein, the PSA test. Okay. So you get a number there. Now, I have to say that the 4K score is better than only PSA. But if we're saying that the PSA test is a problem, then that number, in my opinion, being part of the algorithm may give us a false positive as well. And you know what it has, particularly in my practice, in men with a big prostate, that now they absolutely have a high PSA because they have a big prostate. Oftentimes, however, the algorithm is a proprietary thing that they have, the formula, you can see that they're above 4.7.5, which is the cutoff, and then they get a biopsy and it's negative. So I prefer any test that is PSA independent. And that test for me at this point is a urine test called the Exosome DX test.
Oh,
you pee in it. It's an RNA test. Mm-hmm. It's really, it does a lot of the RNA shedding from prostate cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The number comes up, you compare that to 15.6, and that's more sensitive and it's PSA independent.
Why aren't they using that as a screening test if it's so specific for prostate cancer? Does it make sense to use it as a screen, or is it, it's further along in the process where if there's suspicion, then you use it. Pardon me?
You're preaching to the choir.
Oh, okay. Well,
things take time to adapt.
I see.
Right?
This sounds new because it's the first time I've heard about it. Yeah.
Just because they're science, because there's many people utilizing it, doesn't mean that it's not, you shouldn't use it as a screen to write with the PSA test.
Yeah.
Typically, it's not used like that. I do whenever a patient comes to me and they're trying to avoid a biopsy. I said, well, there's a process here. And it's PSA velocity, density, and an ExoDX urine test. But they're one of the sponsors and one of the speakers, Dr. Punin from the University of Miami, talks about this urine test at the summit.
So let's talk from like a natural perspective here, okay? Because let's say you are in that category of men who are in a holding pattern, in active holistic surveillance. You're going to be monitored very carefully. They'll watch the PSA. If the PSA goes up astronomically, or if a subsequent other test shows aggressive growth of prostate cancer, you're going to pull the trigger. You're going to have conventional treatment. But what can you do? You don't just have to wait for the other shoe to drop, which is what I think conventional urology might say. It's like that they used to call watchful waiting. Well, like, what can I do, doc? Well, no, just hang in there, you know.
It's waiting until they get really bad, really bad. And then we'll do some palliative care and, I don't know, chemo or something.
Yeah. I mean, so this engages the patient in an active process. It is empowering. So what are some of the recommendations? I mean, do you go on a keto diet? Do you go on a vegan diet? I mean, I guess there's some controversy about that.
You're opening up a can of worms.
Sorry.
There's the diet wars, just like there's the political wars and the religious wars.
Yeah.
There's the diet wars.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's, I'm organizing my thoughts here because I know everything that everyone is reading. There's two things. If I'm going to simplify the prostate cancer diet from my perspective, and the only oncology I do is prostate cancer, and that's all I research, is this. It's eat real food, but not too much. I almost feel like I'm quoting Michael Pollan here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, omnivore's dilemma, right, yeah.
Eat real food, but not too much. Eat real food. You're a carnivore? Great. You're an omnivore? Great. You're plant-based only? Great. You're vegan? Great. I don't care. But oftentimes, when you tell me you're a vegan, in my practice, vegans have the worst diets because that just tells you what they're not eating, not what they're eating.
Yeah, Doritos are vegan.
Vegan. And so are ho-hos, and all kinds of things. Absolutely. So some level of fasting, I don't know exactly the prescription, whether it's one day a week. I like dinner to dinner once a week. Whether it's, I like fasting, mimicking diets. I like intermittent fasting, any level of fasting. Then when you do eat, you eat a whole foods, real food diet, very little with a processed food. But I do give some guidelines. I wonder what your guidelines are, Ron, with giving them wiggle. My guidelines with patients are this. If you have 21 meals a day, three of those meals, eat whatever you want. Or
I think 21 meals a week, I think you're thinking.
What, 21 meals a week, sure. Not 21 meals.
I mean, there's some people who do conceivably eat 21 meals a day.
I would love to do that if I knew that was good for me.
Okay, sorry. 21 meals.
Three of those meals, you eat whatever you want. I don't care how processed it is or whatever. No rules. Or you choose one day a week, but you choose one or the other. One full day, eat whatever you want, or three meals a week, eat whatever you want. Those are like my guidelines that I think work very well for people. And then within that, so then is age dependent. or if they have prostate cancer and they're on hormone deprivation therapy. Why? If they're above 60 and or on ADT, I do need enough protein in your diet.
Okay, because it's so catabolic, it causes muscle loss and you need protein to sustain yourself. Yeah.
Metabolic effects to ADT is the killer.
Hey, by the way, just to explain, that is androgen blockade. In other words, things that block testosterone that deprive the cancer of fuel, in effect.
Chemical castration.
Yeah. To put it bluntly, yes.
Yeah. So this is advanced cases of prostate cancer that where they're on androgen deprivation therapy. By any means necessary, I want to sustain as much muscle as possible. So now the protein intake is significant. And so the patient that is a vegan, I just want to ensure they get enough protein. So I want them to have three meals a day and maybe some wiggle room if they're doing intermittent fasting, whether it's not 16 hours on fasting, maybe it's 12-12. I want them to eat enough and have enough protein per meal if they're vegan. Same thing with the omnivore. It doesn't matter, but getting enough protein becomes critical in that scenario.
Is there any truth to the assertion that dairy is associated with prostate cancer? Because rather cruelly, the vegan folks posted a billboard somewhere in Pennsylvania with a picture of the former mayor, Mayor Giuliani of New York, when it was announced that he had prostate cancer. And the heading on it was, "Got cancer? You know, don't drink milk."
Oh my goodness gracious.
And, you know, poor taste, but, you know, they want to grab the attention of people.
That's one way to...
With the assertion that somehow dairy is some sort of hormonal deadly mixture that fuels prostate cancer. Is there any basis for believing that your patients who are dealing with prostate cancer should avoid dairy products?
I think so. Look, there's no one food that causes or cures prostate cancer. Okay? There's no one food.
So in other words, don't overthink it. Yeah.
Don't overthink it, but be mindful.
Okay.
There is enough, nutrition science, Ron, it's difficult. How do you make affirmative conclusions on anything, right? But when I see enough data over data, whether it's animal studies, observational, and those links, and even in observational studies, when they try to control many of the variables and there's links, I'm not going to ignore it. And particularly, you know, how important is dairy? There's a good amount of protein, but people do have, I've seen it, dairy intolerances. So maybe it's the casein. I don't have a problem with whey, but maybe it's the casein and the protein in dairy that's been connected and associated with prostate cancer is casein. So maybe there's something there in ways that I cannot even. So I would say limit dairy unless it could be one of your 3 days or one day a week. I don't care. But you may not tolerate it well if that's what you do. But you want to limit dairy for sure.
Is there some beneficial effect of soy? I know that's controversial for breast cancer because there is a lower incidence of breast cancer among people consuming a native Japanese diet, you know, the traditional Japanese diet. But when the Japanese start eating American, they get the same rate of breast cancer. Does this apply to prostate?
There's no one food that cures cancer, and there's no one food that causes prostate cancer. Okay? That said, just like I tell the plant-based and the vegans, no, the studies do not show that consuming animal products and meat are bad for prostate cancer. I'll tell the paleo people and the soy haters, no, there's no evidence that soy is a problem for prostate cancer. If anything, there is some evidence that it's probably beneficial for prostate cancer. So soy products are fine. Probably fermented soy products, I presume, are even better. Tofu, tempeh, all these things seem fine. If you enjoy, by the way, I love soy and tofu. I really don't like tempeh. I don't like, I don't know about you, Ron. I was vegan in the beginning of 30 years ago, everybody was something in the beginning, right? You have to be radical. If not, then you're not really, you know, part of the group.
We were all macrobiotic at one point,
right? Right. Eating a seaweed and brown rice all day and things like that. You know, so tempeh is like meat texture and wow, I'm getting my meat through tempeh.
But it's ultra processed. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And by the way, ultra processed foods include these vegan things and these, you know, these vegan options and these soy options. Ultra processed food is an ultra processed food. So unprocessed food, not too much, get enough protein after a certain age. One may argue before that as well, but certainly after 60, or if you're an ADT, soy is great. And so is, and some animal products are fine too. If I may add one other thing, the only thing with animal products that there's a high signaling that it may promote is a processed, ultra processed animal products. So things like the bacons and the hot dogs and things like that. I would stay away from those. Again, if I'm going to a Yankee game, to the World Series, Ron.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, I'm going to a Yankee game. I know you're a big Yankee fan.
And so are you. If I'm going to a Yankee game and I'm with my son or whoever, I'm going to have as part of the experience, I'm going to have a hot dog and a beer and Cracker Jacks. That's what we do. And that's my one day or my one meal that I have these kinds of things, right? So these are the same suggestions there. When I say stay away from it is, you know, just be mindful and have it within those parameters.
So let's switch gears and talk a little bit about exercise. I know you're a big exercise enthusiast. You're extremely fit. You do a lot of resistance training. You're super strong. Can you, in a sense, run away from prostate cancer? What do the studies say, in terms of prevention, but also in terms of men who have prostate cancer, or do they have better survival or less progression when they engage in exercise?
Ron, if you and I went into business together and said, look, we're going to patent exercise and we're going to bottle it, we'll be trillionaires in a very short period of time. I don't know of one modality that is more powerful and have more anti-cancer benefits. And I can say that with a lot of confidence now. Before, because I am in an academic institution and I thought there's anti-cancer, but I wasn't sure. So I have to be very careful what I say because I represent my institution proudly.
Yeah.
I can say that now that there's anti-cancer benefits from exercise and prescriptive exercise and movement and throughout the whole spectrum of intensity of movement. So if the person listening right now has prostate cancer or gets diagnosed with prostate cancer, and they're saying, man, I have to change my diet. That's pretty radical. Oh my God, all these changes. Wow, some supplements. What are the supplements? Oh man, that's a lot. Wow, sleep. Oh my God, I have to do that. I don't do that well. And exercise, there's no way I could do it all. I tell everybody, start with exercise.
Okay.
Because you're going to get the most bang from your buck from exercise. The research is overwhelming. I just don't know why every physician is not over the billboard. That billboard in Pennsylvania, got exercise,
right?
You know, lower your risk of prostate cancer. Like, why isn't it everywhere? The research and the evidence is there. So exercise is key. Yes, we could be prescriptive. Yes, I'm prescriptive with all my patients. For example, my patients on ADT, it's not negotiable. They need to do weight resistance 2 to 3 times a week. I prefer 3. That's not negotiable. But I'm very prescriptive. Active surveillance, this. Where do they like? What's their starting point? Oh, zero exercise. Oh, these are cerebral people that just like to be behind computers. Okay, well, here's how you start. Right? Oh, the person that does work out or used to be an athlete and no more. We can personalize it to make it effective, and we can figure out the a minimal effective dose of the exercise for each prostate cancer patient.
And that's a prescription with beneficial side effects, because the fact of the matter remains that even with men with prostate cancer, the vast majority succumb to other diseases prior to dying of prostate cancer, because there's a constellation of diseases that are associated with that. Often men with prostate cancer are overweight. They have metabolic disorders. Their blood sugar is elevated. They have hypertension. And so that teachable moment of you've got prostate cancer really energizes them to take measures that are going to extend their life in general.
It's right.
You lower the risk of the number one cause of mortality in men, things like heart disease, cardiovascular, heart attacks, and strokes. So, yeah.
Indeed. And so finally, and I'm sure there's going to be lots of information about this in the upcoming Prostate Cancer Summit, but our listeners are very attuned to supplements. So without going through a long litany of supplements, which I'm sure you're going to, you know, talk about in the Prostate Cancer Summit, what would be your top three? You know, I imagine vitamin D would be up there.
Certainly. So vitamin D is up there. Curcumin is up there. Curcumin, it's a lot of research on anti-cancer benefits of curcumin, anti-inflammatory, reducing all these inflammatory biomarkers. Definitely curcumin. And the other one would be the medicinal mushrooms.
Okay.
Specifically, I like the reishi mushrooms, but I think turkey tail and all those are very good. Why? Because it seems we need to attack this in different all different pathways. So the inflammatory component is one. The immunological component is very important to kind of activate these natural killer cells that are looking for cancer cells and make sure they recognize the cancer and get rid of it. So those will be my top three.
And finally, I just want to touch base with you on something which may or may not be part of the Prostate Cancer Summit. You tell me, which is a revolutionary approach to the use of testosterone. It was thought for a long time that testosterone is precisely the cause of prostate cancer, because when you do ADT, you actually deprive the prostate of the fuel that is said to cause prostate cancer to grow. That's testosterone. But we have some new think about that, and maybe you can give us a little bit of a preview on that.
Ron, I'm always waiting for you to ask the real provocative questions on your show. Like, okay, it's got wait for it, and there it is.
I always like to put you on the spot, Gio.
On the summit, we have Dr. Helen Burney from Indiana University. And that's a full conversation that we have on testosterone and prostate cancer. Here's some of the points. Testosterone does not cause prostate cancer. In fact, most of the research shows that men who get prostate cancer have low testosterone. I'll take it further. Most of the research shows that men who have advanced prostate cancer typically have the lowest levels of testosterone. So we know that testosterone is not a problem. Fast forward, you get prostate cancer. Oh my goodness, my testosterone is low. I don't want to raise my testosterone. Not true. You get prostate cancer, particularly if you're in active surveillance or low risk disease or intermediate, successfully treated, you can raise your testosterone levels, whether it is through lifestyle and supplementation, which I do very successfully, or TRT, if that's the, you know, testosterone replacement therapy. But getting testosterone levels to appropriate normal levels, human levels, it's a good thing before prostate cancer and certainly after prostate cancer.
And the nice thing about the PSA test is, regardless over the controversy about whether it's good for diagnosing prostate cancer, it's a great way to monitor the potential hazards of TRT, because you can just do sequential PSAs and see if the PSAs are rising in response to the testosterone. If they're not, you're home free.
Let me clarify that part. Your PSA may go up a little bit initially.
Okay. Right.
And then it'll plateau and go back down. So initially, because PSA is made from testosterone. You need testosterone to actually the production of PSA. So once you insert in the body, your testosterone just rises, it's going to start creating and making more PSA, which some of that will go into the bloodstream. So initially, you'll see a rise, don't fret, have a conversation, go, see an expert, of course, and then you'll see it drop again, and then it will normalize.
So I'm thinking that on November 19th, even though I'm in it, and I know a lot of this stuff, that I may want to attend this Prostate Cancer Summit. So how do I sign up for that?
This is the Prostate Cancer Summit. So it's Dr. Talks. Prostate Cancer Summit. So Dr. DRTALKS, Prostate Cancer Summit. You Google that, you'll get it. You go on, put in your name. an email, and then you'll get updates on all the 7 days of all prostate cancer, 40 interviews, bells and whistles. So Bron, I think that this particular event is going to be incredibly useful for, I call them self-health advocates, but also for practitioners.
Yeah.
Because I think there's still a lot of confusion around these topics, and the practitioner is going to also be enlightened by the Prostate Cancer Summit.
Well, I happen to know that among our listeners, a vast majority are lay people, but we do have, I'm really proud of this fact, is that health practitioners, medical students, practitioners across the board, nurses, nurse practitioners, PAs, chiropractors, naturopathic physicians, and even MDs listen to this. And I think that this would be a useful accoutrement to your knowledge about urology and prostate cancer. So great stuff. Congratulations on assembling such a sterling lineup. I mean, I know you've worked hard, but you also have some great connections in the world of urology, and you brought in some great people, and I think it's going to be an exciting event. So we want to make our listeners aware of it, the Prostate Cancer Summit, and the place to go, drgo.com. By the way, you got a newsletter, great newsletter. I really enjoy it. I get it in my inbox every week. What's on tap for your newsletter this week?
This week, nocturia, so nighttime urination.
Oh.
What's the deal there? Men after a certain age, they get up often, and so we want to minimize that. And there's natural.
That's a little too close to home for me, Dr. Gio. As to
I'm not only the client, I'm also the president. Kind of thing. I'm not only the patient, I'm the doctor, but I'm also the patient. Yeah, that's one of those scenarios. And so then we're going to send out on that, and a new research in JAMA that just came out on the inflammatory index foods. And so then that showed in men on active surveillance who have higher inflammatory foods have higher risk of upgrading their prostate cancer relative to those that eat lower inflammatory foods.
And I just wrote an article, and I pick a bone a little bit with them because they have a DII, the Dietary Inflammatory Index, which is actually, it's a work in progress. They keep refining it. But it includes, you know, the obvious things, you know, like sugar, processed foods, you know, chemicalized foods. But they also include red meat. And I got to say that I challenge that because there are some studies that say that red meat per se is not the problem. It's just when red meat is consumed in an all of the above diet, you know, supersize me, you know, give me the, you know, the Big Mac with the fries and the Coke and the, you know, the malt. Then you can have inflammation. But red meat per se, consumed with discretion in the context of a healthy diet, in my opinion, not per se pro-inflammatory. That's my take.
When people come to me and they say, look, I'm vegan, I said, great, let's be vegan. Let's figure that out. I don't want you to be on my diet. If you're on my diet, you're going to have some Cuban food, rice, beans, plantains, and pork. So I don't eat, my diet may not be right for you. I want you to be at your best diet and looking at it objectively and not in a neurotic way. If you look at the evidence, it shows very clearly, red meat is bad. Well, what else are they eating? So red meat eaters typically do eat other things and they drink more. When you look at healthier eating of red meat, including vegetables and all sorts of things like that, then lower risk of mortality, just like any other healthy person. And that's included in prostate cancer as well.
Indeed. All right, so great stuff. Thank you so much for joining us, and all the best. When this rolls out, I think it's going to be great. Thank you very much, Dr. Gio, for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Ron, for having me.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover intelligent medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations. You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to drhoffmanstore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's drhoffmanstore.com. drhoffmanstore.com.